How many of us are there who profess that we would desire to know the truth, capital T, whether or not that knowing be tangible or absolute? Yet who would shrink timidly before the journey into truth is half begun, before the nakedness of some previously unnoticed disclosures about the relative world? Too many of us are like the spinster who refused to disrobe because she considered a naked body to be sinful. Let us pause and ask ourselves what we are. Are we truly the semi-divine creatures that we might imagine ourselves to be? Or are we beasts according to our own definitions and standards? An article was published recently by an expert on jungle life which indicated that we were in some ways worse than beasts. He pointed out that of all the animals, we were the most internecine. The jungle animal may snarl and strike out in competition, but after a little sparring about, the weaker of the two retreats and leaves the prize to the stronger. The weaker is not foolhardy, nor is the stronger one revengeful. There are very few fights to the death among animals of the same kind. Most of mankind's conviction about human divinity comes from man's looking downward, not upward. He endows himself with superlatives because he witnesses other inferior beings. However, man's idea of divinity are somehow tied to morality, and most animals, excepting those who have lived too close to man and those who resemble man, have better morals than humans. In a sort of hypocritical dignity, man enacts legislation affirming the immorality of non-impregnating sex practices. Yet statisticians such as Kinsey and Stokel tell us that the majority of all humans ignore this legislation, some secretly, some openly. Who is it that casts this image that man is innately and irrevocably divine? Where lie the roots of this farcical pretense into which man thrusts his children generation after generation, century after century, and which is accepted so blindly that it has become highly offensive not to embrace the farce in its entirety? The implement that nature uses to bring about this perennial dream of divinity is the human ego. The pretense of divinity is fruitful for the young females who want to affect innocence, virtue, and beauty, or what have you. All are prompted to pose. Then somewhere along the line, with mutual back-scratching agreed upon, the play-acting becomes law. Language expedited the making of a complex drama from what was perhaps previously only a dull biological existence. Little did the Aborigine, who first adorned himself or herself with a feather or bone, realize the revolution that he caused. Nor is man in general yet aware that our billion-dollar cosmetic industry is the result of acts committed by primitive ancestors who found a thrill in pretense. We look further and wonder how much excessive toil and bloodshed resulted from the encouragement of the same love of pretense in other fields. Feathers from the rear of a bird gave dignity to the brow of a chief who in turn made a back-scratching deal with a witch doctor. And thus perhaps our complex society was started. At heart, each man is a killer, a thief, and a rapist. Yet he shows his teeth in a smile. He has learned to deal artfully. In his frustrations at being unable to express himself with true masculine aggressiveness, has resulted in a creature, according to Kinsey, that is inverted, perverted, and bestial. And as a result, his women have become, in their hunger for genuine male relationship, lesbians, fetish lovers, and nymphomaniacs. And where did all of this start? It started with a game of make-believe. Three daubs of blue and a bone in the nose makes one a member of the local medical association, and society was taxed to support him. Then came titles for the chief, for his son, for his queen, and for his favorite flunkies. Each found a feather arrangement peculiar to his station. Then came the rituals that swelled the chests and egos and impressed the slaves. Prostration before the chief and a salute for his generals. Next came deification. The chief could do no wrong. The witch doctor also became infallible, and we trust the natives enjoyed the game as much as we do today. Perhaps there came a day when the natives became restless and tired of the game. Like children playing house, too many were given insignificant roles, and their little egos hungered for some of the inflation. The chiefs saw that this would be a job for the generals if the witch doctors could not handle it. But the witch doctors responded to the occasion. They made everybody important by discovering the gods. The gods took some of the significance from the chiefs, which gave them a bloodless revenge. The gods, in turn, through the mouth of the witch doctors, told them to obey the chief. Thus the generals no longer bore the name of executioner, but of a noble hunter. The innate urge to let blood was vented only on strangers. This further ensured the sleep of the chief and of his generals when they were at home. The first gods were pulled fresh from the hat with little imagination. The sun remained as a god for many centuries because the theologians were accepted as specialists and they were dealing with simple people. When contributions slackened, they discovered new gods. And when language found an alphabet, the need for pattern thinking arose. Now new gods arose with more meaningful names. One of the early abstract gods was Jod. This was a personification of the male regenerative principle. Theology evolved and was improved. However, the improvement was dictated by pressuring kings and high priests. In time, the village chief had grown a gold crown and the witch doctor had traded his nose bone for a tiara or mitre. The natives, now no longer amused or intimidated by god stories, were now given individual godhood. The witch doctor decided that each had a little piece from God, and it was called a soul. The natives, once again, were thoroughly frightened, but many of the chiefs or kings were convinced that their souls were more important than their gold, and the shamans in the long robes wound up with much pillage. Incidentally, a study of witch doctors in Africa, medicine men among the American Indians, and the shamans of Mongolia uncovered evidence that all of them had a common denominator. They were mostly homosexual. There is no intention here to evaluate this as to whether homosexuality abets psychic prowess or whether witch doctoring became the only haven for misfits. It is noteworthy for the researcher to observe the tendency among high priests to wear long robes, and while pretending this to be a mark of modesty, to decorate these robes with sequins, gold braid, embroidery, and even jewels. Again, I wish to insist that this is not an attack upon churches, but upon the ignorance and vanity of man. This by no means implies that man does not have a soul, but indicates rather the gradual evolvement of the soul idea. A very good reference on the matter is Fraser's Golden Bough. We now return to the sequence of evolutionary steps in religion. That which we now call civilization was emerging. The function of the witch doctor became split. The next to appear on the scene were the high priest and the physician. The world of make-believe was growing. The men of specialty naturally studied their parts, and a few of the actors became interested enough in their parts to quit acting and devote their time to study. Still, to this day, most men of specialty are mostly actors. During that period of European history, when the high priests overawed the kings, when the divinity of man was most loudly proclaimed, and when man was exhorted to reflect the kindly and loving nature of God in man's relation to his fellow man, then did the worst savagery of man break forth, and the high priests led the bloodbath like their ancestral witch doctors. The urge to kill is strongest in the animal that has the least to fear. The high priests were now the strongest. Their heads were so bloated with convictions of their own celestiality that they never dreamed that they would automatically revert to jungle instincts. They found excuses to kill their own people who did not pay tribute to their churches. Then they allowed their celibate imaginations to devise instruments of torture. They burned women and children at the stake. A frustrated and impotent priesthood found satisfaction in impaling the helpless. Next, another theological trend began away from the abstract realms of Aquinas and other manufacturers of invisible cloth. The trend was headed for materialistic thinking towards science, metaphysics, and occultism. Perhaps the high priests in the old dogmatic eras thought that they were preaching the truth or creating truth through faith, but theirs was really a period of forgetting. Forgetting their animal nature and their ever-present egos that invariably colored their dogma. Their efforts to impose a dream may have sprung from noble intentions. However, the natives can be roused from an imposed dream if the dream becomes a nightmare. Now, our civilization is becoming increasingly complex. Our make-believe has myriad ramifications. Our theologies have become more subtle, but they still compromise with the powers that control the populace, and religion has retreated, becoming now little more than a social emollient. We no longer put bones in our noses, although the female still wears rings in her ears and feathers in her hat. And we still have a massive form of mutual back-scratching in this system of make-believe, and it grows more absurd daily. We now have church groups which are organizing and lobbying not for control but for a piece of the action, for recognition as being functionally important to the state. Churches and police fraternities campaign not to disseminate the truth but to ban certain movies that detract from their image and dignity. Each profession paints a nice picture of itself, but it would be illuminating to see figures on percentages of crimes committed by policemen, to find the percentage of mentally unstable people among the ranks of psychologists and psychiatrists, and to find the percentage of thieves and alcoholics among the members of the legal profession. It may shock us to be reminded that the uniformed, cold-blooded killer is recognized as a brave man. Yet how much braver is the lone fratricidal killer who has neither the protection of his government or his friends and is confronted only by his solitary convictions as he goes about his killing? It will shock us to know that women, once they have decided to kill, are more vicious than men. And children, trying to be honest, will even kill their parents. Society utilizes children as soon as they are able to bear arms, knowing about their immunity to fear and adult inhibitions. When we walk down a busy street, let us look about us. We see charming people, seemingly. Actually, we are inspired by people posing. The beautiful starlet on the stage or street may seem to be the epitome of tenderness, gentility, and innocence. But give her a few $100,000 and her masculinity will transcend her feminine nature. She will buy and sell husbands, she will abort unwanted children and often die in the process. And her lust will eventually find the headlines of every paper in the world. The quickest catalyst for changing the intended nature of woman, whether she be a housewife or a queen, is power. She is innately hostile, having this mechanism built in to protect her young. It is not uncommon to sink teeth into the male mate. Of course, this is a trait of all mammals, whose instinct is to protect the litter even from the male. The human female is more prone to neglect or destroy the litter than the animal because she is more prone to vanity. She finds her maternal instincts confused by vanity. Let us take another look at the street. We see fancy food stores that sell ersatz foodstuffs. We see libraries that pose as truth factories, but wherein controversial books are banned to the researcher. We see automobile display rooms where vehicles are sold for the curve of their fenders, but not for the worth of their motors or gears. We find acres of floor space for haberdashery and women's apparel, but we may search for a week to find a serious, sensible clothing item. Sturdy building facades have been replaced by enameled tin, glass, and plastic. Frustrated maternal and paternal instincts are evidenced by the many solicitous adults seen curbing their dogs. The corner peddler of nostrums is gone, replaced by loudspeakers and neon lights on the drugstore. The brokerage houses go about their business with a fearful dignity, posing paper empires as monolithic structures, which in reality are eroded by a simple rumor, buffeted easily by winds of chance, and can be sent tumbling by psychological factors not fairly understood by even the most masterful wizards of brokerage alchemy. We see furniture and appliance stores whose business life is inversely proportional to the life of their products. We now go to the professional people. A professional man is noted for his reluctance to speak. He proudly indicates this to be a mark of wisdom, but we know well that he does not even dare open his mouth before too many people until he has become skilled in saying nothing with many words. Even the specialists are inadequate, and they also substitute the act, the farce, for actuality. But we say still that people are basically good and that there is progress from all of this ego-prompted civilization. And in between our most savage and internecine wars, we advance in culture and improve our living conditions. And man also continues to lose sight of himself. People like to be told that they are good. It flatters their ego to be seen in church. It makes them feel very tall to stoop with a nickel toward the beggar's hat, or to write a check for charity if the amount is deductible. Talleyrand once said that words were invented to disguise or conceal meaning. So our acts are often carefully planned to build a certain public picture for the actor. The lover charms the mate before beating her. The salesman is charming to an almost hypnotic degree while promoting a nearly worthless product. How often must Pollyanna be ravished before she settles for common sense and abandons her make-believe? When are we strong enough or tired enough to see the nonsense of it all? And when will we be determined enough to try to sort some truth from the jumble of evidence available? Do not think that only a small percentage of men are motivated by primitive drives. And do not think, while admitting most men to be primitive, that you are not, just because you dropped a nickel in the collection basket or because you were the actor carrying the basket. Our kindness is a mask, and our smile is not too much more meaningful than a similar gesture by an opossum or a hyena. It means stand still and do not struggle while I bite you or put the bite on you. We are cowards, and that which we witness about us is a dynasty of fear and a playhouse of desire. Yesterday and in ancient times, the man who manifested indifference to desire was extolled as a sage. Today, our society legislates that a man must have certain desires or find himself penalized. You may not be allowed to live in a simple unpainted house, nor in a shack across the track. The law will put leavening in your bread regardless of your choice. You must come up to the vanity of your neighbor or be condemned. Your vehicle must look a certain way and function a certain way, or it will not be allowed on the streets. Unless you have a stipulated minimum of cash in your pockets, you will be jailed and the crime will be vagrancy. Our general cowardice manages to keep us from biting one another. In other words, we muzzle ourselves and pick those with the sharpest teeth to go unmuzzled, naming them as our protectors, prelates, and representatives. And as in the jungle, those with the sharp teeth pick off the weak and the slow of wit. We have deified our wonderland and have legislated that all must believe in it to the letter. Only those in charge of the dream planning may alter the dream, and they may alter it only a tiny fraction. Philosophy is allowed, and you are permitted to toy with ideas a bit, but make sure that it enhances the party line of your area, be the dissertation one of religion or sociology. Few will say, "I doubt that." It might be fatal to do so. You must be shrewd, inverted, indirect, and rely on language mechanisms of satire, wit, and the use of parable and fable. This you can learn from any peddler. And never imply that you do not have freedom of speech. This will label you, and some of the labels will frighten you into silence. And now, knowing the risk, let us evaluate the questions that disturb both the wise and the stupid. What is man? Is he merely a compound of chemicals and corruption? Is he cast here for a reason, or is he a complicated accident? Does he have an inner mechanism more important than the body, which in turn is a teleological byproduct of the growth of the inner mechanism? Is there a God? Is he available, or is he evasive? What is the nature of God? And about heaven? Is it important to know first about heaven or first about God? Or is it not better to know first about man? These things are important for us to know. Is there really a divine essence available to those who seek and are sincere? Or are we but miserable children carrying too far a tale about a fairy godmother told by an ancient parent as a soporific? Or is there balm in Gilead, and like a magic wand that makes the corn grow, that parts the sea, enables us to kill our enemies, wards off sickness, and forgives us for the errors of the Creator? Does God approve the sin game? Why do we presume that God is good according to our standards? What do we do to show a profit for Him? Is God a personal being, or will He forever remain impersonal and non-dimensional? Belabored as we are by our competitive vegetative existence, will it ever be possible to formulate a real theological research? What varieties of approach are there to the problem of identifying ourselves in relation to the universe and with the ultimate or absolute? Some say that if you seek, you will find. Others say, "Be still. God will choose you. You can do nothing." It is easy to see that sorting the chaff from the grain becomes a monumental task, and yet what is there left to do for those of us who have tired of the apparent nonsense which perhaps we once appreciated as the game of life? Of course, a very important point arises here. If we cannot see the many instances in everyday life whereby we are fooled, how can we pierce the infinite with this exceedingly finite mind? Still, regardless of the odds, the human mind has a basic curiosity about itself and a hunger for a continuance of life. That is, if present in animals, not as well verbalized by them as it is by humans. The landscape is studded with steeples. The preachers therein may be mostly freeloaders, and 90% of the parishes may be lazy religious hopefuls who lean entirely on their preacher to ensure immortality for them, even as they confidently rely on the plumber to keep their spigots running. Yet man maintains by the steeples an ever-present reminder that vegetable man is not satisfied with himself. If there is a supreme conscious personality which observes the diggings of man down through the ages, he must be well amused by the pathetic efforts and methods of man. We ourselves smile at the aborigine shuddering at a bolt of lightning, and perhaps at the sacrificing of humans to appease the forces of nature. On the other hand, we may be quick to take up the hatchet against anyone who smiles at our particular form of worship, of fear and hope. Scientifically, we have evolved, but we have not figured out the puzzle. We no longer auger the intestines of animals to find the propitious moment, but we still burn incense to appease the gods. And our augury has only evolved into such forms as astrology and the I Ching. There is still an attempt to understand ourselves through philosophy and religion. However, philosophy is like a tongue that spits in our own eye. And where once we had a few religions with many prophets, we have many cults and no prophets. It is possible to outline a system of search for mankind that has magnified and multiplied its superstitions and shortened the hours that might be spent in research by building a Frankenstein civilization so full of waste and nonsense that the exigencies of physical existence take up all of his time. It seems that with each new decade, the chances for man to have an energetic spiritual aim are less and less. Where in our mammoth libraries will we start? How many lifetimes will it take to digest all the theories, beliefs, dogmas, and sacred writings if we are going to proceed in a scientific manner? What an army of tabulators will we employ if we are going to categorize phenomena that relate to our quest? If we are going to take the word of certain mystics and approach the problem through faith, how shall we choose the best sect to which we will surrender? And what questions should precede such surrender? Are there steps of preparation for wisdom? Shall we train ourselves to be meek as oxen who are worked hard and then eaten? Shall we curry favor with those who pretend to know? Or shall we be sly, ignoring all ethics and rules, and with studied trickery outwit the gods who would keep us enthralled? This may sound like sheer nonsense unless we have heard of Crowley, Gurdjieff, and some of the thaumaturgists. We must not fail to mention the hucksters of celestial real estate. Sometimes those who most loudly extol the truth commercialize ignorance. Those who preach humility for others have the arrogance to glibly describe in meticulous detail any supernatural dimensions and at the same time to deny, when cornered, that the finite man will ever really know anything about supernatural matters. We may feel kindly toward the humble, and humility should be commendable for us if we are predisposed toward fatalism. If not, we shall be meek enough when the mortician has finished with us. If we are not submissive toward our condition of ignorance or do not feel complete, then we must proceed as though we expected to achieve as a result of our labor and effort. We must have the courage to strike out on unconventional paths or have the patience to follow a well-beaten path to check out its reliability. In this business of life and death, we should manifest a life and death tenacity. We must be flexible in knowing when to listen, when to be sly, when to communicate to our fellows, and when to remain silent. And in conformity with our dual existence and our bifocusing senses, let us maintain a double approach at all times. We can expect confusion and dismay, but we can lessen our confusion by eliminating the most absurd and the least likely. The frontal attack on ignorance has failed because we struck out for truth, not knowing its direction nor its appearance. Thus, we would not know it if we saw it. Flexibility will here call for a reversal of tactics. Let us retreat from untruth. And while doing this, let us maintain objective observation, experimentation, and analysis for common denominators. These common denominators should be sought in the comparison of religions as well as in the examination of psychic phenomena. There are several other questions which will demand answers sooner or later. Is man hoodwinked by man or the gods? When does a robot become a self-conscious unit of life? Did God decide to keep us in ignorance and manage to by simply instilling in us a complexity of fears and desires and a grandiose ego. In the realization that human frustration and fatigue makes for make-believe, we come to still another possibility. It is possible that make-believe is either an intuition of things to come or is a factor in the creation of events. We find the Flash Gordon of two decades ago becomes the John Glenn of today. This metamorphosis occurs in the destiny of other dreams and desires. Is it possible that if humanity believed in God steadfastly, there would come a time when God would gratefully appear? Universal practice of deception. We begin life with an eagerness to be deceived. There is a delight in magic and fairy tales. The baby has an utter conviction that its mother is infallible. It can conceive of no greater security than to have its nose buried in its mother's breast, encircled by her arms. This is the conviction of instinct, not of logic yet, nor even of intuition. As we grow older, we do not, of a necessity, lose our fetters and suddenly become mature. We transfer one slavery for another. We build mighty rationalizations that are aimed to prove that we are doing or thinking, and yet in most cases all we do is translate the instinctive drive for fetal security into other symbols. When we get a little older, Santa Claus will usurp the maternal chair a little. He will be good to us if we are good, and he will punish us if we are bad. He and his little elves can see all, know all, etc. Then as we grow older, there are other substitutes. For some it will be God, for others law. And for some men it will be simply be another person who reminds them of the mother, a wife. And through all these transfers, the idea of authority permeates and the idea of infallibility. There is magic in being awed, thunderstruck, loved, and punished by that which is almighty and irresistible. And so I come now to this question. Is it ever possible to conceive of a grand architect or first cause without coloring it with emotions that emanate from prenatal or postnatal instincts and desires? Must desire, in other words, answer all our questions? And is any reasoning that bears any taint of desire or rationalization really valid? And if not, is any reasoning about God valid at all until we have more valid information about our own real essence? We concoct a heaven for the delights of our desires and invent a hell for the wicked, who are those that would prevent us from having our dream. Of course, we do not realize that we are also the wicked and must endure the hell that we have created for ourselves. We like to pretend maturity. We scoff at the immaturity of those who believe in another Santa Claus. We feel a certain stature in denouncing all that is not conventional. And we do not hesitate to denounce, even though we know that individual interpretations of conventionality are so varied that they cause chasms of misunderstanding between us and our next-door neighbors. Those of us who wish to stop and think about ultimate directions are jostled by the herd and repeatedly goaded by exigencies of living, so that we wonder if it will ever be possible for other than a very few individuals to pause in this herd stampede long enough to meditate. And among those who have been able to pause for a few hours, there is always present an insurmountable wall of illusion greeting the researcher at every turn. And we must function in the herd and from it take our sustenance, security, and family survival. I think that nearly everyone who has tried to manipulate the Gordian knot of self-definition has been aware of the near impossibility of keeping the feet on two paths at once while keeping the two paths separate at the same time. The two paths consist of the world of pseudo-reality and the world of ultimate reality. They cannot be mixed, yet the illusion of the world of pseudo-reality or the layman's world of materialism definitely have a disastrous effect upon the efforts of a person trying to find the ultimate reality. A person who has an eye open for honest answers cannot help being irritated by the tangles and cobwebs caused by the deliberate social make-believe. On top of this, the path that he chooses to find the ultimate reality will have equally confusing cobwebs, although of a different type. These latter cobwebs will be the result of a relative mind system's attempt to work with word symbols in the abstract fields leading up to the awareness of the absolute, and in describing to others his findings once he has reached it. If we take time out to change society so that it will make a place for the mystic, we will never accomplish anything, unless we have hundreds of years to spend. However, unless we point out the illusions of mass thinking and identify them as herd rationalizations, we may be changed by society into functional parts of it, rather than be allowed to straddle the two paths at once. Somebody said that it is better to light a candle than to curse the darkness. A candle will not do the job, nor would a battery of plague lights, if by candles we mean social work, social reform, and a passive Samaritan attitude. We may as well curse the darkness if the only medium in which we can work is one of social pretense. We make much of our rights in society, and yet we know that each individual man finds himself to be increasingly restricted and compressed into a limited circle of activity. Yet his rights do not guarantee against invasion of other people into his orbit. The process by which a right is usurped is often classified as a duty. We are addicted with the freedom syndrome. We have freedom to worship only in a church chartered by the state. We have freedom of speech on certain occasions, but not through the mail, nor in court, nor in the army. We have freedom to beget children, but once begotten, they are the property of the state. We are free to pursue pleasure, but it must be along herd lines. We have the right to build a house, but we may quickly discover that it does not belong to us. That which we really possessed is a list of obligations to that property. And when the state or a clever group of politicians wants it, they will take it, not by legal suit, but by the stroke of a judge's pen. We are also addicted to the equality mania. Man cannot be legislated equal. He must be found to be equal. And he will be found to be highly diversified and unequal. Herd language, instead of becoming more meaningful with advancing technology, has merely become more confusing double talk, so much so that nearly all his so-called liberties and rights have been reinterpreted. His children have been abused or slaughtered, and yet he has come up dazed and convinced that it all came about as a result of the perfect balance and justice that emanates from the very soul of the herd. Human error is still greater than human understanding, and we must always be aware of the sinister illusion that the masses can vote on wisdom, and of the illusion that an elected officer or piece of legislation is infallible simply because it resulted from voting. Throughout history, gregariousness has produced group confrontations, and when there are no longer remained another herd to confront, it produced repression within the herd. And this led to a lessening of the quality of the members of the herd. On the other hand, history shows that the few people whose thinking actually produced some meaning or definition for mankind were men of solitary habits, men who spent years away from the herd, often in the desert, in an attic, or in prison.